On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Back when defenders of the Iraq War were still sure of themselves, some tossed off terms like roach motel and the flypaper strategy. The idea was that terrorists from around the world would be lured into Iraq and there they would fight their last. They'd check in and not check out. Well, that theory turned out to be colossally wrong. Iraq has turned out to be as good a finishing school for terrorists as Osama bin Laden could have prayed for, and an emerging new safe haven, closer to Europe, closer to Israel, and breathing down the neck of every Arab government in the neighborhood. Now, terror experts are toting up a new, disturbing reality for the region and the world. Up next on Point, global terrorism post the Iraq meltdown. We'll be speaking shortly with three guests who study al-Qaeda from every angle, all the time. But first, we turn to Baghdad for perspective on today's meeting between President Bush and Iraqi leader Nuri al-Maliki. John Burns is Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. He joins us from the Iraqi capital. John Burns, how do you see the most important news to come out of this meeting of leaders in Amman?
Well, my sense is that the Iraqis I've spoken to today are somewhat disappointed. Usually at meetings of this kind, Iraqis do not sit on the edge of their seats. They've got many other problems to think about. There's the problem of survival in the midst of all of this mayhem. This meeting attracted somewhat more interest, which is itself a gauge of how badly the situation has deteriorated here. And there were expectations or hopes, both amongst Shiites and Sunnis, that something really concrete would come out of this. They wanted something from President Bush that gave them hope that this situation is going to get better, and they didn't hear it.
Something concrete like what? What might they have imagined hearing or hoped for?
Well, it may seem surprising to you, but the people of Baghdad, for example, would like the Baghdad security plan, which is faltering and dead in the water at the moment for want of sufficient Iraqi troops. I think many of them would have liked to have heard about an increase in American troop strength here, which, as you know, is under consideration by the Bush administration. There was nothing on that. Some Shiites that we spoke to took comfort from the fact that the president had undertaken to give more authority over the Iraqi military to Mr. Maliki. But among Sunnis, there was a contrary reaction. Since the Iraqi security forces, the American-trained Iraqi security forces, are overwhelmingly Shiite, many Sunnis believe that that will simply mean that they'll be even more exposed to a new and more powerful sectarian militia.
John Burns, what about the prime minister's survival as prime minister, Nuri al-Maliki? Why did he show up late to see President Bush, and does he leave this meeting strengthened by his association with the American president or weakened after this summit?
Well, that's very hard to say. I think that the summit was overshadowed, and seriously so, by the secret classified memorandum that was printed in the New York Times 24 hours before the meeting, which was an assessment by the security, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley and his staff of Mr. Maliki, which was pretty damning, which found in effect that 6 months after his government has taken over, the United States still doesn't have much faith in him, still believes that the sectarian forces, Shiite sectarian forces acting on him, are determinant of the course of his government, and went on, curiously, as I'm sure your listeners know who follow these events closely, to suggest that the United States might want to use its influence to reconstitute the government, still with Maliki as its lead, that breaking him free from the Shiite Religious Alliance, which is, we think, those of us who live in Baghdad and follow this war very closely, is what Tony Snow, the White House press secretary, might describe as smoking rope. It's just not on the cards.
And John, what about the Iraqis and how they read American statements and body language now? The president saying in Amman, the United States will hang in until the job is done, whatever exactly that means. Signals from the Iraq study group that they're talking about withdrawal, no timetable, but sort of leaning the other way. How does the Iraqi leadership, if we can use that phrase in this fractured setting, read American intentions at this point?
I think just the same way as Americans read them, that's to say, They're confused, and I think it frightens the Iraqi leadership, and I think it frightens both Shiites and Sunnis, because I think if there's one thing that the leadership, the Iraqi leadership, can agree on. And certainly one thing which we find very wide common agreement amongst Iraqis on is that whilst they don't like the idea of being occupied, they never have, they like even less the idea of American forces withdrawing and thus collapsing the last major bulwark against this situation going from the disaster it already is to a catastrophe. One Iraqi said to me today, speaking of the United Nations figure for the number of civilians who died in October in Iraq, 3,709, he said, 3,709 in a month, he said, if U.S. forces withdraw, it'll be 3,709 in a day, and in my area alone, and we're talking about Adamir, a Sunni area about 2 miles north of where I'm speaking to you, on the Tigris River, which is exposed to the Sadr city area of Shiite strength, 3 million Shiites, who have already shown that they come out of there when they're attacked and they pick up Sunnis at random and take them out onto waste ground and kill them in the dozens.
3,000 plus in a day, this Iraqi imagines, and that does indeed sound like a path from disaster to catastrophe. John Burns in Baghdad, thank you very much for being with us so briefly today, but thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
John Burns, Baghdad Bureau Chief for the New York Times. They're in Baghdad. We are looking this hour at what the chaos in Iraq means to wider terrorist ambitions and to global security, the Iraq effect, if you will. Joining me now from Washington is Daniel Benjamin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington and author of The Next Attack, which he co-wrote last year with Stephen Simon. From 94 to 97, he was a special assistant to President Bill Clinton and worked with the National Security Council. Daniel Benjamin, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So here we are. It has a feeling of a kind of fork in the road. At least in American perceptions, we're sort of reassessing everything around us. When you look at Iraq and the impact of the turmoil there, the impact of these several years now of war on the global terror picture, what are your big thoughts? Has this put us in a better position, a worse position? What's the impact? What's the Iraq effect on the bigger struggle here?
Well, I don't think there's any question, but this has severely set back our efforts to contain and dismantle the global jihad. I think that within the counterterrorism community, this was clear from the get-go. Unfortunately, most of that community either works for the government or for contractors who can't speak publicly, but there was a strong feeling from early on that this would be, first of all, an enormous propaganda coup for a movement that was in some distress after being run out of Afghanistan, that it would fulfill their desire to have a target on the ground in the Middle East, a lot closer to the beating heart of the movement, if you will, or at least what they view as their fundamental goal, which is the authoritarian regimes of the Sunni Middle East, and that it would just be a galvanizing event, and it has turned out to be all those things and a lot more.
Galvanizing globally via the internet and all the news that lots of people are watching, but what about at the very nitty-gritty level? Is this producing more terrorists, better trained terrorists? Is it now, or is it expected to produce a kind of new Afghanistan-style base camp right in the Middle East? What about at the nitty-gritty level?
On many different levels, it is heightening the threat. Now, at the moment, the threat is principally confined to Iraq, although it has started to spill over. We've seen a lot of jihadist activity in the Middle East itself, which ironically, and most people aren't really aware of this, but most of those Sunni regimes had done a very good job of either tamping down their jihadist problem or exporting it to Afghanistan and other places. So they're seeing activity again. We've seen activity in Kuwait, a country that never had it, a lot of activity in Saudi Arabia, a lot of activity in the Sinai, where there may be other reasons why we're having suicide bombings, but they've appropriated jihadist ideology as a way of explaining it. I think that to your question about whether there's a new sanctuary, I think that the evidence thus far is a strong yes. Anbar province, as intelligence reports, for example, from the Marine Corps that have been leaked suggest, has become a stronghold of Al-Qaeda. It's not clear that Al-Qaeda or I think it's probably more appropriate to say the jihadist movement is the only force there, but it is certainly a powerful one. And it's going to be very, very difficult to clean them out from that region for a long time to come. The Marine Corps reports suggest that we've lost Anbar, that no amount of force that we can reasonably bring to bear will make a difference. But even beyond that, until there is an intelligence service that can work in Anbar province, it's hard to see how these people will be tracked down and put out of business, because they're not just infantry, you know, dug into trenches. They move around and they take cover within communities that are familiar to them.
So there's an emerging sanctuary in Anbar province, the heart of the Middle East. You described Iraq overall as the world's greatest petri dish for bomb-making instruction.
That's absolutely true. When I first looked at this a couple of years ago, I spoke with one of the world's top bomb experts, a former chief of the bomb squads in Northern Ireland, and he told me that what had been achieved by the insurgents in Iraq, and that's not just the Al-Qaeda folks, but also some of the other operatives, the technical strides that had taken 8 years in southern Lebanon and 6 years in Chechnya and 3 years in Gaza had all been achieved in just 12 months in Iraq.
Mm. The president was talking about the situation in Iraq today, steadfastly insisting that one of the top jobs of the U.S. and Iraq is to eliminate Al-Qaeda and other terrorists gathered there. Here he is speaking at a joint press conference in Amman with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki.
I know that we're providing a useful addition to Iraq by chasing down Al-Qaeda and by securing, by helping this country protect itself from Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda wants a safe haven in Iraq. Al-Qaeda made it clear earlier that suicide bombers would increase sectarian violence. That was part of their strategy. One of our goals is to deny a safe haven for Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
To deny safe haven for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but we're reading in the last couple of weeks and hearing today that's not happening. It may be just the opposite. We've been joined by Daniel Benjamin at the Center for Strategic Studies and Strategic and International Studies in Washington. In a few minutes, we'll be joined from London by the editor-in-chief of Al-Quds Al-Arabi, Abdelbari Atwan. You can join us as well, 800-423-8255. And right now, from Washington, Mr. Bruce Hoffman is with us, a renowned terrorism expert, author of Inside Terrorism, teaches security studies at Georgetown University. Bruce Hoffman, thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
The president says one of our goals is to deny safe haven for Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He says we are chasing down Al-Qaeda. Who's chasing down whom here? What's the Iraq effect on international terrorism in your view?
Well, I was somewhat puzzled by the president's statement, because in recent days he's been blaming the enormous escalation of violence in Iraq precisely on Al-Qaeda. So it's hard to see how Al-Qaeda is on the run. And as Dan pointed out, a recent United States Marine Corps intelligence assessment painted an extremely pessimistic, and that may even be an understatement, picture of the situation in Al Anbar, where Al-Qaeda is based. And now it seems that assessment assessment notes is that Al-Qaeda has in fact entrenched itself there.
Says the U.S. military is no longer able to defeat the insurgency in western Iraq. Al-Qaeda now the dominant organization of influence in Al Anbar. Is this the safe haven? Is it a reality already?
Well, it's certainly an enormous setback in the war on terrorism, and in fact, it's playing exactly into Al-Qaeda's strategy. More than 3 years ago, Ayman al-Zawahiri himself, I think, very presciently and astutely summed up exactly what's happened today. And he said in September 2003 that Al-Qaeda already had the United States between two fires. If they stay in Iraq, they'll be bled to death. And if they leave, they'll lose everything, meaning that we'll lose our prestige, our stature, and that our strategy will be overturned. And certainly, I think over the past month, the upsurge in terrorist activity, internecine bloodletting, and just the overall level of violence in Iraq, and indeed the president's statements that Al-Qaeda is behind most of it, suggests that Zawahiri's prognostication is indeed coming true.
Bruce Hoffman, we're struggling hard here to throw off kind of blinkers and blinders and misapprehensions of what's going on. And it's not easy, given the way it's described in so many different ways and it's been used politically and all the rest. You said last month that al-Qaeda is now on the march. Step back for a second with us. Look at what's happened in Iraq and give us, to the best of your ability, step into al-Qaeda's shoes or the global jihadist movement, as Dan Benjamin says. How do they look at what's going on here, where they stand now in relationship to their goals?
I think, unfortunately, the only conclusion one can reach is that from al-Qaeda's viewpoint, nothing succeeds like success. They've successfully, I think, revitalized themselves in recent years. We're finding more and more evidence that some of the major terrorist attacks and plots in Europe are not, in fact, organically produced homegrown radicals committing them, but rather there's an al-Qaeda element based in Pakistan and elsewhere that has consciously subverted some of these societies and is orchestrating these attacks. Mm. And indeed, in Iraq, we see this tremendous upsurge in violence that, as the president has said, is laid at the doorstep in part of al-Qaeda. So al-Qaeda, I think, is clearly recovering from the setbacks that we did mete out to it in late 2001 and throughout 2002 in Afghanistan and throughout the world. They're now revitalized and they're marshaling their forces to carry on this struggle. And they believe, though, that they've now turned a corner.
I want to look at how that may reach out and touch Europe or the United States, but Daniel Benjamin, first, just in the region. Again, look at it from al-Qaeda's perspective, given everything that's gone on and going on in Iraq. How do they see the regional playing board right now, do you imagine?
I think they're certainly encouraged. You know, as I mentioned before, the jihadist movement was largely dormant in the Middle East in the late 90s, in part because countries like Egypt did such a good job at cracking down. And in fact, it was all of those successes that had caused bin Laden and his cohorts to make their sort of strategic shift to decide to attack the United States instead, because they felt that they were losing at the if you will, the national level, and they wanted to be transnational.
But look forward as they see it now. How might they see their opportunities?
Well, they see their opportunities as being pretty rich, I think. Look, just take one example. People shot up some Syrian jihadists, it appears, or radical Islamists shot up the U.S. embassy not too long ago in Damascus. Mm-hmm. It was inconceivable, and there's a lot about this that's remained somewhat vague, but it was inconceivable that such a thing could have happened just a few years ago. Syria, under the father of the current leader, under Hafez al-Assad, had actually waged a war within its own country, killing thousands of people to stamp out the radical Islam. So I think that they think that things are getting a lot better for them. And, you know, just to come back to what the president was saying, when we invaded Iraq, there was no al-Qaeda in Iraq to speak of. Now, in addition to the foreign fighters who have been drawn there, there are now thousands of Iraqi jihadists who have been radicalized by the struggle there. So we face, quite simply, many more radicals than we did before.
And Bruce Hoffman, your analysis of the regional situation, if you're in bin Laden's shoes or wherever you put the locus of al-Qaeda guidance now, what's the opportunity list look like, the target list?
Well, I think at the top of the opportunities is, from bin Laden's perspective, is a realization or a belief that they have dealt a significant blow to United States strategy in the war on terrorism, and that they've certainly weakened the United States military by enmeshing it in Iraq. So in that sense, just in terms of perception, I think he and his movement will certainly feel emboldened, not just to carry on the struggle, but perhaps to expand it. I think we're in a dangerous time now compared to, let's say, the post-Afghan period in the 1980s, after the Red Army withdrew from Afghanistan. I don't see so much now the issue necessarily as personnel or people bleeding out from Iraq. Mm-hmm. Something like 90% of al-Qaeda in Iraq now is estimated to be Iraqis themselves, and I think there'll be plenty of fighting in Iraq in years to come to keep them occupied. But all you need is a handful of people to return to Europe or to travel to Europe to bring the technology and the wherewithal to stage roadside attacks with improvised explosive devices, to stage suicide car and truck bomb attacks, to stage remote control mortar and rockets attacks. And you have a level of terrorism that we just haven't seen outside of conflictual areas like Iraq like Lebanon. And on top of that, I think that the inspiration, that the success that al-Qaeda in Iraq and other fighters have achieved in that country against, after all, the United States military isn't only the most powerful military force in the world today. It's the most technologically advanced military in the history of mankind. Now, if a bunch of guys with garage door openers and cordless phones can challenge this military, I think it has an enormously inspirational and emboldening effect on terrorists throughout the world, who similarly will think they can challenge much more powerful enemies.
And remind us of the big goal here and calibrate what strides have been made toward it. The caliphate and all that, put in simple terms, what is al-Qaeda gunning for?
Well, al-Qaeda's always had, I think, a very sort of a very evolutionary ideology that's gone from a decade ago their very narrow aim of forcing the United States and Britain to withdraw its military forces from the Arabian Peninsula, from Saudi Arabia, in more recent years to a grand scheme to recreate the caliphate and impose transnational or supranational Islamic rule over all those countries that at one time were ruled by Muslims. But I think fundamentally they believe that time is on their side. And what we may think or write off as sort of, you know, tactical setbacks for ourselves in the war on terrorism, they see as enormous successes. They see as stepping stones on the way to their eventual triumph.
Triumph looking like what? One Islamic nation across the whole region, Israel there or gone, looking like what?
Well, I think when they dream about what they seek, it's certainly a transnational Islamic empire that would be of historical proportions, that would stretch from Andalus, from Spain, across North Africa, through the Middle East and the Caucasus, south to South Asia, to Southeast Asia. But I think hand in glove with that is an intermediary step they see basically paring back United States power and indeed international power. Their enemy is as much the United Nations as it is the United States, and they see a weakening of anyone's power to interfere or to intervene with their grandiose plans.
Let me take a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hello. Let me just make a quick comment. You know, some of the people at work have been talking about that now it's becoming crystal clear what the problem is in Iraq. And that is that you have all these different divergence of desires. You know, if you had one desire, it moves the force in one direction. But when you have a pulling of different directions, it seems unsolvable.
You mean Sunni and Shia and all the rest?
Yeah, correct. In fact, it's very disturbing why we haven't had more success. Now I'm thinking, what's going on? And I keep thinking, America keeps thinking, what's going on? Well, now it's crystal clear. You can bring a horse to water, but you can't make him drink unless he has the desire. But so I was also one of the ones who said, let's just get the heck out. But now, you know, this morning I'm thinking, you know, a different way that we should study for this reason, that that if we pull out, and this has been said before, that if we pull out, the insurgents will only get stronger, and the fight will not be there. It will be here. So which one do we want? It's just that simple.
Tom, thanks for your call. Daniel Benjamin, you hear people trying to figure out what makes sense here. What about the in or out question for American troops, and what makes it better or worse at this point on the global terror front?
Well, this is a very, very difficult question to answer satisfactorily. One of the ironies here is that while we are there, we are certainly one of the reasons for escalating violence because of the resentment at occupation and because of the Sunni insurgency, which is comprised of both al-Qaeda-like elements and non-al-Qaeda elements. At the same time, if we were to leave, as John Byrne said, we'd see a much higher level of violence. One of the myths, I think, that has grown up is that if we were to leave, the terrorist threat would inevitably grow. I guess I think that the terrorist threat may very well grow if we leave, but the possibility of very large-scale violence is really riveting and very disturbing, and that we could also see, actually, in the wake of a lot of the sectarian violence, that al-Qaeda would be diminished, that, in fact, the Shia would try to slaughter the Sunnis and especially those who are radical. I think that the myth that there's going to be a jihadist state in Iraq needs to be shot down. The vice president in particular has made this argument. I don't think it's very plausible, but I do think that an enduring presence in Iraq is quite plausible.
Sounding damned if you stay and damned if you go, but that's not an answer to this. Daniel Benjamin, Bruce Hoffman, stand by for a moment. I want to turn to London. We're joined by Abdelbari Atwan, editor-in-chief of Al-Quds Al-Arabi, leading London-based Arabic newspaper, author of the just-published book, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda. And he should know, he met with Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora years ago, one of the first and still one of the best interviews ever done with the Al-Qaeda leader. Abdelbari Atwan, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome, my friend.
How do you see Al-Qaeda's standing deep in the Iraq conflict now? Who's won? Who's lost ground? Is Al-Qaeda, as Bruce Hoffman says, on the march?
Yes, I agree with Bruce here. Al-Qaeda is in the march. Al-Qaeda now is 10 times more stronger than it used to be in Tora Bora. Al-Qaeda enjoying a safe haven in Iraq, a safe haven with 50 million pieces of arms, a safe haven of 5 million tons of ammunition, and a huge reserve of frustrated Sunni community in that part of the world. When I say Al-Qaeda is winning, I can see the strategy of Al-Qaeda is actually implemented in full. For example, Al-Qaeda wanted to drag the United States to a war in the Middle East where they can fight the American troops in their own turf and their own grounds, and that's what happened. Osama bin Laden told me personally when I interviewed him that he cannot go and fight the American on the American mainland, but if he managed to fight them in the Middle East, this is a great thing to happen. And it seems the invasion of Iraq fulfilled this prophecy. The other thing, Al-Qaeda actually worked for a civil war in Iraq, and the civil war erupted. It is true President Bush is saying it's not there yet, but it is there, and you can see at least 4,000 people are killed every month. So
they've got the Americans in the region. There's a civil war. What's next on the Al-Qaeda dance card?
Yeah, the card, you know, they ignited this civil war in order to drag the regional Sunni reserve to be involved directly in Iraq. So they ignited this civil war, hoping that Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, United Arab Emirates, other Sunni Arab, Turkey, to intervene in Iraq on the side of Al-Qaeda, on the side of the Sunni. And that's what is going to happen. Saudi Arabia yesterday, the advisor to the king of Saudi Arabia said, we will send money, we will send troops, we will finance insurgents or resistance in Iraq to counter the Iranian influence. So it seems Egypt hosted Haris al-Dari, the highest Sunni authority in Iraq, and he was actually red carpet reception for the first time. So it seems that Sunni Arabs are interfering now on the side of Al-Qaeda without planning that. So Al-Qaeda's strategy is working now.
Even though these are some of the same governments that Al-Qaeda has vowed to overturn.
Oh, yes, definitely. That's it means Osama bin Laden has a vision. And is this vision is start to come true. Now the Sunni Arab, as I said, are mobilizing their financial capabilities, their military capabilities to protect their Sunni brothers in Iraq to actually indulge in the civil war. And this actually what Al-Qaeda wants. So it seems until now, Al-Qaeda is winning.
Muna's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Muna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm originally from Iraq, and I left Iraq a long time ago, but I remember when the occupation first started, the Ba'athists swore that they will resist by having a guerrilla war. And if we go back to Saddam Hussein and then his sons, they said we will resist by a guerrilla war from street to street. So to me, this seems like a resistance of the Ba'ath Party, and they really do it in the name of Shiite or Sunni. Iraq has been a society of Shiite and Sunni for the last 1,400 years. Iraq society is almost 5,000 years. They lived in harmony.
But does that mean to you that the conflict is self-contained, that all they really care about is what goes on in Iraq, or can you imagine Iraq becoming a base for regional or global terrorism?
Well, yes. If we leave it like that, I think right now the Ba'athists and the Al-Qaeda are joining together, though they have no common things between them, but they are following the saying that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Al-Qaeda doesn't want any occupation in the Middle East, and they want to have the jihadists to govern, and then the Ba'ath Party is resisting, and they don't want to lose their governing power.
Which they lost when Saddam fell. Muna, thanks for your call. Bruce Hoffman What about it? Are we at a point where, a Shiite-dominated government, where the U.S. would be better off to see it very powerfully in charge, crushing the Sunni? Because Abdel Bari Atwan says the Sunni are now allying with al-Qaeda. What about the balance of power in Iraq and how going forward and how it reflects on this regional global threat?
Well, the Sunni alignment with al-Qaeda, especially in al-Anbar, I think is a very dangerous development, and it really is one of the tipping points in this conflict, in that what this means is that the Sunni are placing their faith in terrorists or militias to protect them, not in the United States and certainly not in the Iraqi security forces. But of course, you know, the United States' attempt to play sides and to back the Shia would have enormous consequences in the region. I mean, obviously, the Saudis are very concerned about this. They asked the vice president, or according to some reports, summoned the vice president to Saudi Arabia just this past week to discuss with him regional events. The consequences of a strengthened or a resurgent Iran, given our difficulties with the Ahmadinejad regime, are singularly unappealing. The fact that the Shia could control between Iran and the southern part of Iraq, a large percentage of the world's oil supply, is not something that we should readily welcome or embrace as some sort of a quick solution to this enormously complex problem.
Let's expand the circle here. Abdel Bari Atwan, look at Israel. Here it sits on a region all three of you are describing as increasingly fluid and not in a calm way. What are Israel's stakes here, and is it part of a target list?
Well, actually, yes. I believe there are three stages of al-Qaeda strategy. First one is to fail the American political and military process in Iraq. Second, to actually reach Israel by all means and destroy the Zionist entity, as they call it. And the third stage, to topple Arab regimes and establish the caliphate. So I believe al-Qaeda is getting closer and closer to Israel. We know that they are in Iraq, and I wouldn't be surprised if the situation in Lebanon explodes and we have a failed state in Lebanon. So al-Qaeda will set bases there. And there are a lot of reports that al-Qaeda already has bases there. So if this is the case, Israel will suffer because this al-Qaeda will be in its border and maybe trying to send those suicide bomber rockets. So the Israeli actually made a grave mistake when they did not actually pursue the peace process and gave the Palestinians what they want, independent Palestinian state. Now al-Qaeda is using the Israeli occupation, using the Israeli atrocities as a pretext actually to launch more attacks against Israel in the future. The Israeli is a potential target.
Let me ask you, Daniel Benjamin, what about Israel's situation here? Israel's been very effective, successful over the years in countering nation states, in fighting neighbors when they did, they've been militarily muscular and strong, and nation states have basically leaned away. If it becomes more fluid, more terrorist, the threat does in its profile, is Israel in a less advantageous situation? Is it in a defensible situation?
Israel's situation is indeed getting more difficult. I guess I would answer the question by saying the greatest near-term threat is to the stability of Jordan, which has a huge border with Iraq and specifically with al-Anbar, which has already suffered spillover in the bombings almost exactly a year ago of hotels in Amman by Iraqi jihadists, which has a large population of radical Islamists who are sympathetic to Iraqi jihadists, and which is simply not a very wealthy state that can buy off its opposition the way Saudi Arabia has. And if Jordan is destabilized, then Israel's security is really in grave danger. The possibility of having two failed states on its borders in Lebanon and in Jordan would be really catastrophic. There are al-Qaeda groups in Lebanon, particularly in some of the Palestinian camps, and it's a bad situation. The curious thing is that Israel has benefited in some strange way from having Hamas and some of the other Palestinian groups as their opponents, because they have been opposed to having catastrophic attacks against Israel, those that would take out hundreds and thousands of people, and they have actually kept al-Qaeda out of the territories to a large extent. How long they can do that remains to be seen as the social situation in the territories continues to fragment.
Bruce Hoffman, pull the curtain back a little further then. I mean, this all began for many Americans, in many Americans' minds, with 9/11, an attack on the USA. If we look to Western Europe, if we look to the United States, if al-Qaeda is making these strides, being advantaged by what's happened in Iraq, what's the direct threat on these fronts? Is the direct threat so important anymore? Or is the meltdown in the Middle East so, you know, a kind of a universal threat in itself that al-Qaeda doesn't need to attack in the U.S. or in Europe?
No, absolutely not. I think this is what makes this picture so immensely depressing. I think al-Qaeda is operating on multiple fronts, and as active as they've been in Iraq, for example, is just a reflection of their desires to be as active in Europe and indeed to target the United States. I mean, we saw just this past August a massive plot disrupted that involved intentions to down 10 U.S. aircraft simultaneously over the Atlantic Ocean or to crash them into targets in the United States, which again suggests that as much progress as we made in the war on terrorism, we still have enemies that are even going after the hardest of all of our post 9/11 target sets, commercial aviation. Just last month, earlier this month, mm-hmm. Eliza Manning and Buller, the director general of MI5, the security service in the United Kingdom, described how British authorities had disrupted 30 terrorist plots in that country, many of which they believe are connected to al-Qaeda, that they're currently shadowing some 1,600 terrorist suspects. So what we see is that al-Qaeda has been able, over the past decade, I would argue, to build up something of a terrorist infrastructure in Europe, probably not in the United States, which is why they've always had to import terrorists to this country. But clearly, in the late 1990s, British authorities had discussed something of 3,000 British Muslims who had left the United Kingdom to train in al-Qaeda camps and had returned to that country. And I think the plots that we're seeing, the suspects are being followed or watched, or a manifestation of, I think, a real al-Qaeda threat that extends beyond the Middle East and South Asia.
So watch out all over. Let's turn to Wayne, calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Wayne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Point I'd like to make is this is all very, very disturbing, and I think it's very disturbing that the president continues to have such lack of vision and such lack of realism with what's going on around him and painting unrealistic pictures and whatnot. I think perhaps the biggest, perhaps best solution that the world really can hope for is just to wait his term out and wait for the new elections with the hope that we can get a more competent president who can perhaps bring some leadership to the world stage. And
but Wayne, that's 2 years away, and we've got a fire burning here.
What else can we do? I mean, you heard the president yesterday. He refuses to budge. His dad sends his people in. He refuses to listen to them, the Baker Commission. What can one do? I mean,
Let us pick it up. It's very disturbing, Daniel Benjamin. When we listen to what all three of you describe, the kind of what would appear to a citizen ineptitude in the handling of this since 9/11 is just breathtaking. I'm looking here at a new report. MIT Security Center for International Studies, Stephen Van Ever, says Bush administration weak on terror. The public was thinking it was strong. What about the way this particular administration has responded so far, and do you see it changing? What about 2 years before an election and a change at the top?
Well, I've been critical of the administration's strategy since before the invasion of Iraq and wrote about that many months before it happened. I don't see any great hope in terms of a changing tactic. I think this is a president who has decided this is the issue on which his administration rises or falls.
But it's fallen. You're describing a situation that could hardly be worse.
Well, I think that the president's interest will be in depicting it as somewhat different than that. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that with all the different horror scenarios that exist for what could happen in Iraq, radical change based solely on dealing with the terrorist threat is probably not in the cards. The fact is we are worried about a far greater civil war breaking out there. And although I've said for a long time that I do not think we will be able to turn around the terrorist threat until we're out of Iraq, We can't just walk out the door from one day to the next. So we've got a real problem. We are in a perfectly bad situation in that both of our all of our options are really unenviable.
Let me go to Rupert in Providence, Rhode Island. Rupert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Listen, before anything else, this is exhausting, this whole subject. I don't know if other people feel the way I do.
Well, I do, but what are you going to do? You've got to stand up and look at it, right?
Here's the solution. Never mind the experts. We've listened to them. They're the ones who got into this. We should just get everybody out, not only from Iraq, from the whole region. Pull everybody out, close our embassies, hand them the keys and say, good luck, guys. Call us when we need
Rupert, them. I mean, do you mean that? That's where the oil comes
really
from, that keeps
that.
The lights on. You could have a, you know, if all of that goes anti-American and armed, can we really live with that?
Absolutely. And Israel can take care of itself because Israel has proven over and over again that it has the means to protect itself.
Well, it has had. Bruce Hoffman, is there any retreat strategy for the U.S. here, or do we have to step up and address?
Well, I think we have to face the facts and realize that we've failed to solve the problem of Iraq, and perhaps it's insoluble, at least from our vantage point. But I think that if we fail to solve the problem in Iraq, it's time to think about containing the violence in Iraq and stepping back, not seeing our military power enervated and depleted in Iraq, but rather withdrawing, not from the region, certainly, not from the international arena, but rather redeploying, undertaking some form of damage control in terms of our reputation and status, strengthening our allies, such as in Jordan, in Egypt, and elsewhere, and having a presence in the region that's designed now to ensure that the problem of Iraq doesn't spread. And in that respect, you know, El Anbar in the western desert of Iraq is not like Afghanistan in the 1990s. It's very susceptible and amenable to the use of air power to strikes that could contain the problem. But for the first time, we need really to be thinking ahead and thinking of how we're going to manage and contain a problem rather than continually attempting to solve something.
Abdul Bari Atwan in London, if you were to suggest a course correction to the United States, if this one hasn't worked so well, in large terms, what would it be?
Well, actually, I believe the United States should not actually create this mess and leave. I think they have to clear this mess before they go. Sorry, the whole policy, American policy in the Middle East, is a disaster now. And I believe because they never listen to the people in the region, they are listening to the people who are actually advocating for wars.
So stay and do what? Stay and do what, sir?
No, what they can do, actually, if you look at the American invasion of Iraq, creating all this mess. So I believe the first thing is to put a timetable for a full American withdrawal and to actually enhance democracy in the region, to say to the Israeli, enough is enough. We have to solve this problem, which is really muddying the water there. And without this, without these steps, I don't think, you know, we will see any light at the end of the tunnel. As I said, full withdrawal from Iraq, solve the Palestinian-Israeli problem, and promote democracy, real democracy in that part of the world, with investment, creating jobs, and you know, making life better for those people. If the three steps is really done, I think we will have different Middle East. But as long as jumping from a war to another war and trying to insist that what the Americans doing in Iraq is the best thing, I think this is a disaster.
Abdul Bari Atwan, editor of Al-Quds Al-Arabi in London, author of the new The Secret History of Al-Qaeda, thank you for being with us. Bruce Hoffman, you've been critical of the whole war on terror framing here. Is there a better framing at this point?
Well, I think we have to move away from a conceptualization that relies on war, because that implies that this is a problem that can be solved or addressed through military force only. I've advocated for some years now that we should treat this rather as a global counterinsurgency that would bring to bear all the instruments of national power, that would give an emphasis to diplomacy, to economic reform, to political development, and especially to information operations. And that would be, I think, a much better approach to this problem than casting it as something amenable to a military solution.
And does it still work when things have reached this state, a counterinsurgency approach globally?
Well, I don't think we have any choice. I think that, you know, you can't reinforce a policy that obviously isn't succeeding. So I think that certainly historically one seen that when you've had a counterinsurgency approach to these unconventional type of threats and challenges, that it's certainly borne more fruit than the policy that we've pursued thus far in Iraq the past 3 years.
Mm. And there's our time today. A tough report, but we're listening. Bruce Hoffman, author of Inside Terrorism at Georgetown University, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Daniel Benjamin, author of The Next Attack and The Age of Sacred Terror. Mr. Benjamin, thank you for being with us today.
Again, my pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.